Well, no, it is customary in good schoolwork to have an occasional quotation from authority. That sort of adds the proper note of elegance to any research program. And therefore, this evening, I want to read two or three very brief extracts to indicate another phase of our problem. The question is sometimes asked, who believes in Atlantis? Is it merely the old belief or superstition held fondly by a romantic group of thinkers? Or do we have something more substantial? And, of course, hunting around in the files, I've come across a few things that might have some interest to us. I'd like to mention that in 1912, M. Pierre Termier, of the Academy of Science and the Director of Service of the Geologic Chart of France, delivered a lecture before the Institut Oceanographique in Paris. For some reason, no one seems to know why, this lecture was translated and published completely in the annual report of the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian Institution for the year ending June 30th, 1915. And from this translation, we have selected two brief notes. The French savant addressing the Institute declared, "It seems more and more evident that a vast region, continental or made up of great islands, has collapsed west of the Pillars of Hercules." He doesn't seem to qualify that, but I rather like his climax, because with the true spirit of a Frenchman, he had to really become a wee bit dramatic. So this appeared in the report of the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian Institution, quoting M. Termier. "I dream of the last night of Atlantis, to which perhaps the last night, the great night of all humanity, will bear semblance. The young men have all departed for the war, beyond the islands of the Levant and the distant Pillars of Hercules. Those who remain, men of mature age, women, children, old men and priests, anxiously question the marine horizon, hoping there to see the first sails appearing, heralds of the warrior's return. But tonight the horizon is dark and vacant. How shadowy the sea grows. How threatening is the sky so overcast. The earth for some days has shuddered and trembled. The sun seems rent asunder, here and there exhaling fiery vapors. It is even reported that some of the mountain craters have opened, when smoke and flames belch forth and stones and ashes are hurled into the air. Now on all sides a warm gray powder is raining down. Night has quite fallen. Fearful darkness. Nothing can be seen without lighted torches. Suddenly seized with blind terror, the multitude rushes into the temples, but lo, even the temples crumble. While the sea advanced and invades the shore, its cruel clamor rising loud above all other noises. What takes place might well be the divine wrath. When quiet reigns, no longer are there either mountains or shores, no longer anything save the restless sea asleep under the tropic sky." Can you imagine that appearing in the report of the Board of Regents, Smithsonian Institute? We didn't realize they were so fond of literature. But this points out the point that we want to make, namely that this subject has intrigued some very interesting people. And in connection with interesting people, there are some of us, a little older, who remember Vice President Charles G. Dawes. You remember him of the underslung pipe, and who later became ambassador to the court of His Britannic Majesty at St. James. Mr. Dawes took an interest in this strange subject for some reason, and he financed a search of the Vatican Library in hope of discovering among the musty old documents some key to the enigma. The investigation is carried on by a Yale scholar, and is particularly concerned with the Mayan dialect. The Vice President entertains the hope that the strange hieroglyphics deeply cut into the walls of temples or into the faces of mountains will, when correctly read, forever settle the Atlantis problem. So they come from a very interesting group. We all remember Donnelly, Ignatius Donnelly, who wrote a book on Atlantis. And we rather think of him perhaps as a wool gatherer also. But let us also remember that at one time this same Donnelly, under his real name, was a United States congressman and had quite a little to do with some very interesting and important legislations of a most practical nature, and not concerned at all with abstract or romantic subjects. And I found this also, which rather pleased me in bringing it out. Did Atlantis exist? A publication of the United States Department of Interior, Office of Education, Washington, D.C. Now, I'll give you the big surprise of all. There is not one statement in this report adverse to Atlantis. Every line in this is in defense of it. I'll read you one example which will be indicative. There is a ridge between 6,000 and 8,000 feet high running through the Atlantic Ocean. Deep sea soundings have revealed a great elevation or ridge, which rises about 8,000 feet above the floor of the Atlantic Ocean, and it reaches the surface of the ocean in the Azores and other islands. This ridge must have been above the water once upon a time, because the mountains and valleys of its surface could never have been produced except by agencies acting above water. It is covered with volcanic ash, traces of which are found right across the ocean to the American coast. Now, the entire article is in this temper. So here we have an interesting sidelight on our so-called mysterious problem. The only reason it is mysterious is because we have been in such a hurry to do other things, we've never gotten around to it. But the importance of it in our thinking deserves a great deal of further consideration. In our field, it is perhaps more important than it is in the field of geology or related sciences. We know, and no one has dared to deny, that the surface of the earth has changed a great many times. We know this because we find fossilized seashells on the top of Mount Blanc, and we have also found fossilized marine life in the highest peaks of the Himalayas. These areas had to have been underwater. If mountains rising 25,000 feet above the sea level today were once underwater, we have no difficulty in imagining almost any kind of transformation in the surface of the earth. Now, last week, we devoted most of our time to a rather specialized phase of our subject, and that was the basic account as preserved by Solon and transmitted by him through his descendants to Plato. Here we have a fragment, an isolated account of the submergence of a vast island continent, a submergence which has, of course, strong moral and ethical significance. This, however, we must approach with some caution. We must realize that it was not very long ago that almost every evil that befell mankind was regarded as an act of punishment from God. This attitude has so long persisted and is so ancient in its universal acceptance that we must realize that such an attitude would be almost inevitable, regardless of the nature of the destroying or destructive forces. We also have, however, in the story as given by Plato, only a fragment of something. This story, in order to be meaningful and intelligent, must be supplemented by such material as I just read. Material that indicates one very important point, namely that the submergence of a continent is part of a vast and continuing process which has since resulted, even in historic times, in lesser submergences or emergences from the sea of areas of land, islands, peaks, and so forth. Naturally, vast disturbances require vast periods of time. Plato makes no point of this, nor does he go any further than to tell us of a condition which existed some 10 or 11,000 years ago. Obviously, this is not and cannot be all of the story. We are further strengthened in this conviction by another logical and reasonable fact. The Atlantis described by Plato was a highly civilized, highly cultivated empire. An empire which had brought many arts and sciences to a peak of achievement. An empire which has mythologically been regarded as a great beginning area of sciences, where perhaps knowledge that we do not possess today was then available, and arts and crafts had reached a prodigious degree of unfoldment. This tells us, beyond any question of doubt, that we do not have all of the story in Plato. We are dealing with an incident, perhaps the final submergence of the last part of a great distribution of land and water area and surface. For the further advancement of our thinking, therefore, we must pass eastward to those great areas of philosophy and religion where scientific minds, strangely profound in their learning, have given us more of this story, have given us elements which we definitely need to complete a reasonable reconstruction. In the Oriental philosophy, Hinduism, and related philosophical systems, what we term the Atlantis story, which they use other names to signify, is not merely the account of the sinking of a continent. It is the account of the gradual growth of land and water distributions and the distributions of populations upon the surface of our planet. One of the old writings says that the Great Mother, our Earth, has shaken many races from its surface or from its back in the long periods of prehistoric time. We are inclined to agree to this, that for a vast period of time, peoples have been growing and developing upon this planet, and that it is quite inconceivable that man, as we understand man, should have emerged as recently as we would like to imagine. If, however, in the course of ages, vast and incredible catastrophes occurred, it may be a long time before we are fortunate enough to hit upon some of the vital facts, largely due, perhaps, to the circumstance that so much of the disputed area is now deep under seas and oceans. To the Oriental thinker, therefore, Atlantis is not merely an island in the Atlantic. Atlantis is a distribution of continents. Atlantis was not just in what we call the Atlantic Basin. Atlantis was all over the Earth. It was a distribution similar to our present distribution. Children going to school today learn about Europe, Asia, Africa, Central and South America, Australia, and other parts of the world. We use a map or a terrestrial globe in which this distribution is obvious to us. The Indian thinker likes to refer to this present distribution as the great Arya distribution. In other words, we are living upon a distribution of land, water, areas. And on this distribution, we have dark races and light races. We have many nations, many cultures. We have a long and illustrious history. We have a mercantile, a trade, and all these things. And we have continents that are slowly but inevitably changing even as we map them. 100,000 years from now, the map will not be the same as it is today, although the differences perhaps will not be as heroic as we like to associate with the Atlantic distribution unless, again, we run into heavy seismic occurrences. So in the east, the Atlantean continent was a distribution upon which developed and flourished the Atlantean race. Now, the Atlantean race is that which immediately preceded the great Arya migration from northern India. We do not like to use large terms in large, generous ways, but to the Eastern mind, this great Arya migration and the classics and the great writings is assumed to have moved as early as 1 million years ago. Now, of course, as we told you the other evening, the very thought of such distant times causes the modern anthropologist to shudder. He doesn't want to think of these things. He wants everything to be recent and up to date. But actually, we have much to support the belief that at a remote time, perhaps 1 million years ago, the progenitors of the Aryans, the Aryas as we know them, moved downward from the Trans-Himavat across the great Indo-Gangetic Plain, through the great channels cut by the Indus, the Ganges, and the Jumna, and down these great plains moved a wandering nomadic people. This people was ultimately to conquer the world. This people was to supply the races with which we are most commonly concerned today. From the early part of these migrations came the great Arya Hindu race. From it also came the Persian, the Iranian. From it came the Greek and Latin. Also the Celtic, the Anglo-Saxon, the Teuton, and finally the polyglot, which we call the American. These peoples all belong to this great Arya migration. This migration, moving downward from Central Asia, did not move into an uninhabited world. When these peoples met the original inhabitants of India, they came upon the Dravidians, a very ancient stock. And here in the world today, we also have ancient and mysterious stock, such as, for instance, the Basques and other culture groups, which cannot be traced directly, either by racial structure or by language, to any of the dominant cultures that we know today. These peoples moving down did not immediately expand, probably, very much beyond the boundaries of Asia. They moved down into that great land of India. They moved across, perhaps, to be stopped finally by the mountains that border Afghanistan, and on the opposite side, by the seas that divide China from Japan. But in this area, there was a tremendous motion. And this motion ran more or less head-on into one of the great Atlantean motions that had preceded it. And that motion was China. And there is no doubt that what we call the Mongolian today is the principal surviving type of the Atlantic culture. The Mongolian was an Atlantean. And the struggle between the Mongolian and the Aryan in the dawn of history, almost before there was history, has supplied some of the choicest elements of world mythology. Now, while this struggle was going on in a remote area of the world, the old civilization, the civilization that was gradually being displaced, had passed through a variety of catastrophes. These catastrophes began in the breaking away and breaking off of the tremendous continental areas that had at one time practically formed a solid land pattern in the entire area that we call the Atlantic, extending from the north up above around Greenland and across to the northern parts of Scandinavia, and on the south that probably joined Brazil with the coast of Africa. It also included certain parts of our own country, now still above water, a situation that will later be more valuable to us when we begin to study the tradition on the Western Hemisphere. It also reached over into Europe, involving a great deal of what we call Western Europe, and particularly the areas of Spain, Portugal, and North Africa. In other words, we had a tremendous land area there. And over this land area, in the terms of a conquering people, in the terms of an ancient culture firmly established, we find the Atlantic Empire supreme in that phase of the Earth's development. Being subtly but distantly challenged by this young blood rising from the Himavat and coming southward in Asia, but so far away, so remote, that for many thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, these two cultures never came into direct impact. Certainly, there is every reason to assume that this is the case. There is also every reason to assume that gradually, what we call the Arya civilization and culture became aware of this great culture in the Atlantic Ocean area. But they were also aware that this culture was composed of an ancient people who had become master of the earth, but who had become old, tired, and weak, and were no longer able to protect or defend the great boundaries of their state. Thus, there seems to have been, at a comparatively early time, a gradual encroachment by the beginning of the Arya stock upon the old Atlantean stock. And this forms a fringe circle of legends for which we have no other reasonable explanation. This fringe circle of legends has something to do with the eternal division of human beings into two groups. These groups represented in the Persian philosophy by a battle between light and darkness, always between good and evil, between the new and the old, between youth and age. And this battle we find recorded in China, and also we find it recorded in India. Now, it's been always a question as to how it happens that to many Indian scholars, the island of Ceylon is regarded as a very ancient area, and why the Indian peoples have often associated the island of Ceylon with Atlantis. This particular point is interesting to us. You'll remember that on the island of Ceylon also are the so-called footprints of Adam. And it was believed that the first man stepping down upon the mortal earth left his footprint there. Why, therefore, this particular land should be so differentiated is worth another thought. Over Atlantis, there ruled seven kings. These kings being tutelary to the great central government. Over the island of Ceylon, which was then known as Lanka, ruled a king with seven heads, apparently a type of government, an order of administration, a council. This king was called Ravan, or Ravana, and he was held to be an evil person. And in the great Indian classic, the Ramayana, we find the struggle between Rama, the incarnation of the sun god, and the wicked king Ravan, king of Lanka. Now this seems to be a thinly veiled account of an early struggle between the ancient Aryas and the Atlanteans, resulting in the discomfiting of perhaps one of the great territorial areas that had been under Atlantean sovereignty. That this is not as strange and fantastic a belief as might first appear is evident if we begin to study a little bit. Consider the power, the strength, the glory, the security of the Roman Empire. And then how, out of the distance, out of remote and wild and ferocious regions, there came a barbarian horde that overthrew the decadence of Rome, and the culture of Rome perished under the Goths and under the ancient Huns and by those who had so little actual attained culture of their own. Decadence meeting youth, the new overwhelming the old. Every mythology in the world carries parallel stories to this, and seems to have a bearing upon our principal theme. If we wish to assume, for example, at the moment, that through a gradual distribution and redistribution of land and water areas, over a period perhaps running into a million years or more, that the continents as we know them began to emerge as we recognize and study them on maps today. By degrees, they took their present form, with two exceptions. That in the area of the Indian Ocean and extending out into the Pacific, there was another great continent, Gondwana land, which is sometimes referred to as Lemuria. On the opposite side, between America and Europe, there was still a considerable insular continent, a vast island, which represented the last of the great Atlantean distributions. These two areas, Gondwana land, in the shallow waters that can still be measured in the East Indian archipelago, and the Atlantis, the summits of which remain today as the Azores Islands, these two were all that were left of a great distribution which may have flourished as long as 4 million years ago and gradually broke up, scattered, fragmented, in the constant motion of seismic forces until at last the Atlantic island and the more distant and less understood Lemurian continent remain practically the only map details vastly different from our own as we know them today. The legends and myths seem to imply that the ultimate and final form of the Atlantic island, the Posidonis of the Greeks, perhaps remained comparatively unchanged for a long time. It may well be that the history of the Atlanteans on the island of Posidonis, with minor changes, minor variations, and constant and small encroachments, may have continued for 25 or 50,000 years with comparatively little major change. However, in this course, we know that the ancient peoples lost their contact with surrounding areas. That is, they lost their direct contact, and we do not know how much destruction was wrought in the processes which destroyed that contact. We know also from Plato that they reestablished this contact in another way, through the process of setting up vast colonization projects, by which they extended out again into the primitive areas around them, areas in which the remnants of still older peoples still existed, and more or less fulfilled the pattern which we described last week. Thus, there is no actual inconsistency between the Greek story and the Indian version. The difference lies principally in timing. The Indian version assumes a much greater antiquity and a much longer continental history than we find in the story as told by Plato. The Indian version also, however, gives us the same moral lesson, namely that this ancient land that was submerged, the demons that were submerged, according to the Avestic writings of the Persians, that these were submerged because of evil, because they had departed from the ways of light and of truth, and that the city of the Golden Gate had become corrupt with luxury, that the Atlanteans had departed from the laws of their great founding gods, and that because of this decadence, they gradually opened themselves to the wrath of heaven. Actually, fictional writers and others have tried to fill in something of the condition of the Atlantean, and from the Oriental versions, we gain other rather useful notes. It was the belief of the Hindus that the Atlantean distribution began with a race of giants. They believed that in those ancient times, the human being was considerably larger than he is now. And some have gone as far as to point out that remains, human fossilized remains of gigantic stature, have actually been found. These were the giants of Genesis, the giants of the Book of Enoch, the giants of the Zohar, and other books which deal with the antediluvian world. These giants apparently were, however, the very early Atlanteans, for gradually we see a change taking place in practically all of the fauna of the earth, and man is not completely exempt from the rules applying to other creatures. We are not surprised or amazed when we reconstruct the skeletal remains of the dinosaur or the brontosaurus or any of these vast prehistoric mammals. We are not surprised to learn that there were bats 12 or 15 feet of wingspread, that there were animals 40, 50, 60 feet in length or more, that there were birds that were larger than any bird that we know today, that reptiles and other forms of life went mad in their form constructions, and that this earth was populated with monsters. Monsters as described by Bosaurus in his Phoenician and Chaldean history. Monsters of long ago. These were the dragons of ancient China. These were the strange, shadowy monsters that arise in the nightmare folklore. That such situations could have existed, we know, because we have the remains of them. That man himself may also have been included in this process, this gradual reduction of size over a long period of time, a reduction resulting from the need to differentiate the mental structure of man's life. As more and more energy was required for mental brain function, as creatures by evolution required more and more acute sensory perceptions, and as the struggle for survival in a half-finished world became less and less acute, we see forms gradually reduced in size. We observe the gradual diminishing of animal size, and we perhaps can sympathize with the Oriental or the other ancient thinker who believed that man passed through a somewhat parallel diminishing of stature. The Oriental, however, does seem to like to remember the Atlantean as a person of heroic and vast proportion, a kind of giant, a giant in comparison to other men, perhaps 8 or 10 feet in height, certainly larger and stronger than those with whom we are usually acquainted. However, in time, this also seemed to have diminished until today the remnant of the Atlantean, as we know him, is a person of ordinary stature. Now, if we go back to our Indic mythology and our Chinese mythology, with which we are especially concerned, we note something of great interest to this point. Nearly all of the ancient heroes, the ancient gods and godlings of the East, were giants. When represented in statuary or carving, they are always represented larger. They are represented as of mammoth proportions, and the human being kneeling at their feet is of much smaller stature and less massive build. Now, we are told, of course, that this can be a symbolical situation, that by size is indicated spiritual importance. This perhaps is true. It could well be true in modern or recent art. But did our remote ancestor have the same feeling when 5, 6, 8 thousand years ago he carved in this way? Was he acquainted with our explanation? Did he have the subtlety to make this fine distinction, using size to represent spiritual achievement alone? It is unlikely. It is more likely that he was basing his art concept either upon legend or lore, which related to the actual existence of giants or of persons of extraordinary stature. In almost every instance, reference to peoples or tribes or nations that could have been Atlantis indicate these gigantic persons, these giants. And these giants are the ones that passed away in limbo long ago. And the later Atlanteans certainly did not have such proportions. The next thing that is important to us is to remember Plato's remark that the Atlanteans were the first to wage war. So let us go back a little bit, both in the East and West, perhaps definitely in the East, to see about these wars. Now, we know in the Bible, for example, that there is a report of a war in heaven. We do not say that this war in heaven necessarily refers to the Atlantic situation. But we have a long, prehistoric, mythological tradition of war. War fought in remote times. And even as these legends go backward, these warriors do not fight with clubs and stone axes. And in your ancient mythological representations of prehistoric war, we have the gods fighting. We have heroic beings hurling thunderbolts. We have magnificent creatures in gilded armor and in bronze mail riding upon war chariots in the sky. We have great armies moving, not as bushmen or as some aborigine, but the armies of light and darkness, the armies of good and evil, the armies of Michael the Archangel, splendid, magnificent productions of artistry at a time when, according to our modern thinking, these people should have been wandering around in fur robes, if any, wielding stone axes. What about these ancient wars that were fought before the earth was formed, according to the Indian tradition? Wars for space, wars for earth and sky, wars between the Suras and the Asuras, wars between the Rishis and the Arhats of magic, and the awful sorcerers and demons that dwelt in the dark underworld. These wars were splendid campaigns, and they went back a very long way. There is no history that does not have them. There is no legendary that does not remember them. And the fact that these legends were written, compiled, or memorized 3,000 or 4,000 years ago has no difference. These wars were always fought long ago, even then. Far before the dawn of history, before there were men, there were monsters and giants fighting in the earth and in the sky, like the Greek Titans and the strange emblematic and symbolic Hyperboreans that came down from the winds of the north, and against whom the Greeks felt so great a terror. All this seems to bespeak something that is not just what we have generally assumed it to be. We cannot just simply say that all these ancient wars recorded in China, in Japan, in Persia, in India, in Egypt, Babylonia, that all these ancient wars are just myths. Why should they be? Why should we imagine that our more remote ancestors, who did not have our psychological complications or our addiction to romantic dramatizations, why should they have done this? Why should they have all done the same thing? And why should these wars always come long before the foundation of the nations which we are immediately considering? These wars came in the East before India. They came in the Near East before Persia and Babylon. They came in North Africa before Thebes and Memphis and the rise of the dynastic kingdoms of Egypt. Always long ago, far away, the gods and demons fought. And even in some cases, there came out of the new races heroes who fought the old demons, who fought the dragons that guarded the treasures of the earth. And out of the struggle between giants, monsters, and men, there came what Carlyle calls the hero myth. The myth of the modern man as we know him, defending himself against terrors and horrors that we have no actual record of. Where do these psychological stories come from? Let us assume that they do represent, as some of our psychologists would have us believe, kind of archetypal dreams. Yet others of our psychologists insist that man cannot dream of something for which there is no reality somewhere, that he borrows from his environment and from his memory and from the traditions of his people these things which he will gradually metamorphose into personal dreams of his own. This is largely the concept of Jung in his work on psychology and alchemy. It is the concept that man is borrowing archetypal symbolism. But where was the archetype? Where was the archetype for the war in heaven? Unless to man it represented some mysterious occurrence in the dawn of himself. An occurrence that is so remembered that, like the deluge, it is scattered everywhere, throughout the world. We know that the Egyptians have their story of the deluge, that it is upon the totem poles of the totem Indians of our northwest, that the Hopis and Navajos have their legend of how their ancestors came up through the earth on corn stalks or reeds to escape the rising of the waters, which were the results of the anger of gods who dwelt under the earth. Their symbolism is preserved for us in their elaborate sand paintings, and in many of their more interesting and important rugs and weavings. We also know that in the valley of the Euphrates we have the same, and there are marks of water erosion nearly 200 feet above the ground on the outer face of the Great Pyramid of Giza. We know that the Sahara was underwater. We know that the Gobi of Mongolia was underwater. And how are we going to fit the circumstances of these strange records into this history which we mentioned to you before as belonging to once upon a time, a fairy story. A story which, however, lingers within the subconscious of man. If we believe that it is possible, genetically, for man's past, the collective past of his race, to be reborn through him in his subconscious memories, it is quite possible that locked within ourselves is the symbolism of the lost world to which we once belonged. If we believe in rebirth, the same concept may be locked within the psychic being that moves from life to life. For if there was an Atlantis and we are reborn, then we were the Atlanteans. This would give us a considerable food for thought, and might point out that as from our environment we attain certain inevitable conditionings, that from the greater geological environment of our world, the entire anthropos, the total body of man, has been conditioned since before the dawn of time. His conscious memory has no record, but what we call archetype may well be the dream locked in himself, the dream of terrible memory, memory that gradually breaks through here and there in some sensitive or unusual person, the dream which perhaps was rescued by priests and sages from long ago and was locked in their ancient stories, fables, and histories. In any event, we are dealing with a very intense psychological problem, one that we cannot easily overlook. Now, in India, the first official avatar of Vishnu, we know that the deity Vishnu, the personification and extension and embodiment of the great being who rules all things in space, the sovereign power. That Vishnu, taking upon himself the body of a fish, and called later in the sacred writings the one who was born from the fish's mouth, took upon himself this form in order that he might rescue a good man. So we'll go to the Hindu myth and see what we can make out of it. Long time ago, the world was ruled over by the gods, and peoples were true to the gods and loved them and served them. And finally, evil came, and selfishness and pride. And in the beginning of the Dark Age, evil became so completely rampant upon the earth that the spiritual truths were no longer regarded. And at that time, a demon arose, who stole away the sacred book of the law and carried it and hid it in the depths of the ocean. This demon who stole the Veda, or the law, taking away from man the light of truth, sought to enslave man with error, with false doctrines, and to lead him into bondage and servitude, to the selfishness and arrogance of mortal kings. And when it seemed an obvious that great trouble and great catastrophe was inevitable, there was a good man among these people, and the gods came to this good man and told him that he should build a boat, and that in this boat he should take himself and his wife and their three sons and their three daughters, or daughters-in-law, the eight persons, and that they were to build this boat, and when the deluge came, they were to float upon the surface of the water. And Vishnu, in the form of the great fish, took the rope or cord and steered the boat through the sea and brought it and finally to safe landing. And then Vishnu, descending as a fish into the sea, fought with the great demon that had stolen away the law, destroyed the demon, and rescued the Vedas and brought them back, that the new people of the new world, populated by the good man and his family, might then have again a golden age of truth. Now, we do not know the date of this writing, but we know that it is considerably earlier than the legend of Noah. And yet the legend is exactly, essentially, and basically the same. Now, in the Chinese writings, we have also a very important legend. For in ancient times, the same thing happened in China. And when in the great cyclic life, the day of the great darkness came, the Chinese prophet and sage, who had been instructed by the gods, fashioned a boat. And into this boat he went for safety, taking with him his wife, their three sons, and the sons' wives. These eight, then in this ship, floated over the oblivion. And these eight are now referred to as the eight essential trigrams, or the basic diagrams of the I Ching, or Classic of Change, the great divinational book of science known to the Chinese. Well, they consist of yin and yang, the broken and the whole line, which are, of course, the wife of this patriarch and the patriarch himself, and the three positive diagrams and the three negative diagrams, which represent the sons and their wives. These eight diagrams, by multiplication, become 64, 8 times 8. And these, as Confucius said, are the roots of all knowledge upon the earth. And out of this darkness, out of the great tragedy, rose again the eternal teacher, Fu He, born from the fish's mouth, who became the first human emperor, and upon from whose dynasty the great empire of China claims descent. And Fu He is represented usually by a face standing or rising from a mountain, carrying in one hand the brush and making with the brush the strokes, the eight diagrams, which are the basis of all learning. This story is very often repeated in Chinese folklore, and while we've abridged it considerably, I think it parallels closely enough with the Indian story and with the Noah legend, which is, of course, deep in the mythology of the Valley of the Euphrates, that we have very little reason to question the essential principles involved. Thus we have at the roots of peoples everywhere the deluge, the great darkness that descended upon the earth. Now, in the early writings as preserved in the book of Genesis, the word deluge, as we find it in the Bible, does not necessarily mean a flood of water. It means an oblivion, or darkness, a horrible catastrophe of some kind, a sort of drowning out in space. It may or may not represent actual water. In most of the legends, the type of term used will have the same general meaning. It can mean either water or oblivion. In the Chinese, it is called the water of oblivion. Now, this you can translate as you want, but it does not necessarily signify merely water. It means the blotting out, the destruction, the sweeping away, the complete obscuration of a kind of life or a way of life or some pattern involving the removal of a culture or a people. If this legend then has some foundation in a belief or in a valid doctrine, we then perhaps can appreciate why the Hindu, in thinking of this, also makes this their Noor or their patriarch to be the founder of a new racial order, a new pattern of life, a new dispensation of peoples, and that from him descend a new kind of world, a world in which the old has passed away. We have the same story essentially in the great writings, the Eddas and Sagas of the North. We know, for instance, in the Elder Edda, we have this whole world of the gods, ruled over by Odin, or later in the Sigurd Saga, we have variations of this in the great family of the Volsungen. But we have the gods living in a world apart, with a marvelous temple on the top of a mountain, corresponding exactly with Plato's description of the city of the Golden Gate. This great mountain is represented in the Eddic literature as in the Midgard, or middle garden of the world, a flat surface in the midst part of the great Yggdrasil tree, or the tree of the universe. In the midst of this universe is an island, and in the midst of this island rises a great mountain. And the mountain and the island are surrounded by sea, and the cliffs around the edge of the sea are the eyebrows of Ymir, the primordial hoarfrost giant. This island kingdom, or a wonderful mountain, is connected to the plains below by a bridge of rainbow. And on the top of this great mountain is the palace of Asgard, also the great hall of Valhalla, where the soldiers and heroes feast forever. Here also is the throne of Odin, where he sits, judging the world with his one eye that peers out over everything. And gradually, in the course of time, according to the runes and the fates, and according to the warnings of Erda, the great mother of the earth, who is to represent, in a sense, the planet itself, the worms gnawing at the roots of the tree of life, gnaw through the roots, the great tree, the world of the gods, the mighty palace of Asgard, all of the glory that we have in the great Götterdämmerung of Wagner. All this vanishes into the ocean. The seas rise, or in Wagner the Rhine rises. And little by little the world of the gods vanishes forever under the waters. And in the place of it is only darkness, night, and the new dawn that is to come. And on a high peak that escaped the deluge, in a cave, hid two persons, a man and a woman. They became the Adam and Eve of the new race, and they remembered only in their dreams and in their thoughts and in their fancies the ancient world of the gods that was gone forever. Now take all your legend away from this for a moment. Bring it straight down to the most simple possible interpretation. And this great saga of the North, this pathetic tragedy that was sung by the bards and the skalds, this is actually an almost exact parallel to Plato's description of the Atlantic disaster. Here on the great plain of Ragnarok, Odin and his armies of light fought against the armies of darkness under Loki and the Fenris wolf and the Midgard serpent and all the forces that came out of darkness and the ghosts and souls of the evil dead in their ships made of human fingernails. All these legends, you can reduce the legend. You can take away the dressing and the drama. But what remains seems to be the story of the destruction of an antediluvian world, a world that had once been. And this Asgard, this temple of the gods, seems to very closely resemble the mysterious temple of the city of the Golden Gate, rising in the peak in the midst of the island of the lost Atlantis. That such could have been the case, that these legends could have arisen from this source, it is difficult to deny. The stories are too consistent, the details too parallel. If then such is the case, and such might well be the case, let us again consider the gods upon Olympus, the great godlings of Greece, the gods upon the strange mountain of the north in the ancient Egyptian mythology. What was the heaven world of the Greeks? Was it truly a spiritual state far beyond the sky? Was it a place where divinity, in absolute and eternal virtue, dwelt forever? Actually, no. Nor is this true of the gods of India, great Indra and his court. Nor is it true of the gods of Egypt, great Amun and his retinue. For the legends and myths that we have of all of these mythologies are permeated with a very strongly human flavoring. We like to assume that perhaps men did not devise gods better than themselves, and therefore had trouble imparting to their deities virtues that were dim in their own conscience. But I think we have more than that. There seems to be no good reason why ancient man should have created constantly and consistently a heavenly world that was 90% mortal. The gods of Greece and the demigods and the heroes were not infallible. Zeus made just as many mistakes as men make, and he had just as nagging a wife as any unhappy mortal ever possessed. The same is true of the Egyptian gods. Re was a mighty deity, but Isis bewitched him and fooled him completely. All these heroes, like Achilles, had their heels and had those vulnerable parts of themselves. There were constant bickerings and contentions in the world of heaven. Even evil Loki guided the blind Hoda to fire the mistletoe arrow that slew the son of Odin right in the midst of heaven. All these things seem to bespeak that this heaven was not the kind of world that we may think it was. Perhaps this heaven was man's dim remembrance of a glory greater than his own. The doings of these ancient godlings, which in most cases led to their final corruption and destruction. For these old sagas are the stories of the falls of gods, and of their gradual departure from men. The good gods retired and never came again, and were not seen any more, and did not walk any longer with men in the garden in the cool of the evening. They vanished away. The bad gods slew each other and disappeared in limbo.